Hi, I'm Dan Lothian, the executive producer for The World. I want to take a moment to extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who has donated to The World's fall fundraiser so far. Thank you. We are able to produce the best in international reporting with the highest production value because of listeners like you who stepped up to support The World financially. This drive is critically important in sustaining our reporting year-round. Recurring gifts are especially impactful. They ensure we have the resources to be meaningful with our time, to ask consequential questions, and to dive deep into hard issues. It allows us to plan ahead so we can spend more time thinking about the coverage we'd like to bring you next week, next month, and even next year. We are aiming to raise $67,000 before the end of the year, and a generous donor has offered to match your gift one for one. Every gift gets us closer to our goal. Can we count on you? Please visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. Once again, thank you. And now the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
A former high-ranking American diplomat charged with spying for Cuba.
This was a shock to all of his former colleagues, and I think they're also asking questions of how he was able to keep this double life up for so long, if indeed the allegations are proven true.
I'm Marco Werman. Israeli forces are starting a new and more difficult phase of the war in Gaza, attacking the southern city of Khan Yunis.
For Hamas, Khan Yunis is like Stalingrad.
A troubling comparison, as we will hear. Also, something big might actually come out of the climate summit in Dubai, and an endangered species of salamander on the verge of extinction. Luckily, it's got a cool name and a secret weapon.
If you're an axolotl, you need your permanent smile to get people to be excited.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us. It is one of the most brazen and long-running betrayals in American diplomatic history, say U.S. officials, who have charged a former American ambassador with being a secret agent for communist Cuba. Manuel Rocha spent decades at the State Department while he was actually working for the Cuban government. Joshua Goodman helped break the story for the Associated Press. He says what we know about Rocha comes from the accused diplomat's own words. Rocha was secretly recorded by an undercover FBI agent last year. I spoke with Goodman about his reporting earlier today.
Rocha pretty brazenly talked about his past services to the Cuban government. He praised Fidel Castro. He talked about the U.S. as an enemy, and then referred to some specific historical incidents in the rocky relationship over 50 years of Cold War diplomacy between the United States and Cuba.
So Rocha was operating as a spy during the Fidel Castro years, correct?
You know, he's not accused of espionage as of now. That could change. There's going to be more charges presented, I think, today. But he is accused of acting as a foreign agent in the interests of Cuba. And so, you know, he's been out of government for quite a number of years. But certainly when he was in government for 25 years from 1981, he would have been in a position to betray lots of United States secrets, not only about Cuba, but also about Cuba's allies in Latin America.
Is there a way to know how much damage he did as a Cuban agent?
We need to know that pretty soon. And there's been a lot of calls from people, former State Department officials, exactly in that direction. You know, there's a lot of things that people are looking at. For example, in 2002, he spoke out very forcefully against a candidate in Bolivia, Evo Morales. He said, if Evo Morales is elected by Bolivia, it will cut off USAID. Well, those comments backfired, and almost Evo Morales in that election won. He ended up winning 3 years later anyway. But people now are taking a look at that incident to say, hey, was this a deliberate sabotage on the part of an ally of Cuba to basically lose a strategic relationship for the U.S. in South America. Another example, he was in Cuba at the special interest section at a time in the 90s when two planes launched by exiles in Miami flew over and basically tried to drop leaflets encouraging Cubans to rise up against Fidel Castro. Those planes were shot down. Four people were killed. And in the recordings that are part of the criminal complaint against Rocha, he references those incidents.
Joshua, as you think back to like the major turning points in the last couple of decades in Cuban-U.S. relations, are there other moments where Rocha could have had major influence?
Most certainly. The incident that I described with the planes flying down in the 90s, that was a period of really intense fights between the Cuban exile community in Little Havana, who really wanted to maintain pressure on Cuba. And I think governments in Washington, which were much more open to trying something new after a half century of failed trade restrictions. So he could have clearly had a voice in that debate.
So considering Rocha was spying for communist Cuba, he was seen as a right winger, a conservative. How does that factor into these allegations of being a foreign agent?
Yeah, he talks about that in the recordings, that he assumed a right wing guy's disguise to really fool people inside the State Department and foreign policy circles. This is the thing that I think really stings in Little Havana today. So many people in the city of Miami knew Ambassador Rocha as a trusted ally for right-wing Republican policies towards Latin America. And now, you know, they're obviously distancing themselves from him. And a lot of them, I think, feel fooled.
I mean, it all feels very Cold War, but of course, the Cold War kind of still exists between Cuba and the U.S. I'm still wondering, though, what has or what would have the Cuban government gotten out of employing Manuel Rocha as a foreign agent in more recent years?
You know, the relationship between Cuba and the United States is largely defined in Little Havana.
In Miami.
And that was Manuel Rocha's base of operation these past 20 years, basically since leaving government. After he left government, he was a special advisor to the commander of U.S. Southern Command.
Wow.
He maintained a lot of relationships with business in the region and elite foreign policy circles. He would have had access to lots of information, maybe not classified information like he would have as a diplomat, but there remains a real unknown about that information. I mean, in the criminal complaint itself, there are not a lot of details about what information he provided the Cubans or whether he received any compensation for it. It's basically a admission of past services provided to the Cubans. And, you know, the specifics are very short, but his sort of effusive praise of the revolution leave no doubt that he was a fellow traveler, according to prosecutors.
Why did the FBI target him? Like, how did Rocha slip up and become the object of this sting operation?
That is the great mystery. The criminal complaint only refers to the fact that the FBI learned of his covert activities prior to initiating contact with him in 2022. It also mentions that there were others involved, but we don't know what led the FBI to suspect him of anything. And I think that's going to be a great mystery going forward that I'm going to be looking into, and I'm sure others as well.
What happens next in this case, Joshua?
Today, the prosecutors said they intend to present additional charges to the grand jury. So we'll see what those are, if anyone else is charged or if there are additional charges on Rocha. He has a bond hearing on Wednesday. The government has said that he is a flight risk and under no circumstances should be allowed to be freed before trial. And he'll then later this month have an arraignment where he'll be able to enter a plea of guilty or not guilty.
Associated Press reporter Joshua Goodman was speaking about his reporting with Eric Tucker about former U.S. diplomat Manuel Rocha, who has been charged as a foreign agent for the Cuban government. Joshua, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Ireland is one of the few countries in Europe where the far right has not gained a strong political foothold. There is no seat in the Irish parliament that has been won by a far right party. Election campaigns by extremist politicians have all ended in failure. But riots in the streets of Dublin last month are raising fears that things might be changing. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
It was still rush hour in Dublin when crowds of mainly young men, hoods up, faces covered, tore through the city centre one evening last month. They set police cars on fire, attacked buses and trams, and looted closed doors. It was the worst street violence Ireland had seen in decades. The riots followed news of an attack earlier that day.
It's early afternoon in Dublin, and there's panic and confusion. three young children stabbed outside a primary school.
Within hours, messages appeared online claiming the attacker was a foreign national. Police said later that the man was an Irish citizen of Algerian origin. One voice note on the messaging app Telegram called on people to go to the city centre and to, quote, kill foreigners. In Dublin that night, some of the rioters waved the Irish flag. Others held up placards that read Irish Lives Matter. The following morning, Leo Varadkar, the Irish Prime Minister, said the crowds had brought shame on the country.
These criminals did not do what they did because they love Ireland. They did not do what they did because they wanted to protect Irish people. They did not do it out of any sense of patriotism, however warped. They did so because they're filled with hate.
There have been several anti-immigrant protests in Ireland over the last few years. In September, a couple of hundred people gathered outside the Irish Parliament building and erected a mock gallows with headshots of Irish politicians stuck to the frame. Police officers had to escort lawmakers out of the building as the marchers shouted abuse.
Enemies! Enemies! Yes, our enemies!
Traitor!
The population of Ireland has jumped in the last 20 years from around 3.9 million back in 2002 to more than 5 million today. 20% of the population was born outside the country. Still, in the last general election 3 years ago, immigration was not a big issue. And the far-right candidate who did best managed to win just around 2% of the vote. But next time around, some political experts say, things could be different.
I fear that we may well see some far-right candidates elected to the Dáil for the first time.
That's John O'Brennan, professor with the Department of Sociology at Maynooth University. The Dáil is the Irish word for parliament. Last year, the country took in around 100,000 refugees. Rents for the general population are also at an all-time high. And there's real public frustration at the lack of housing. John O'Brennan says far-right activists are tapping into this anger. So far, though, the movement has one obvious weakness.
There is no single charismatic leader for the disparate number of parties to coalesce behind. I mean, some of these leaders are an embarrassment. There is no Geert Wilders. There is no Nigel Farage.
But O'Brennan says that doesn't mean a new, more magnetic leader won't emerge in the next few months. Niamh MacDonald monitors the activities of far-right groups in Ireland. Her organisation, the Hope and Courage Collective, works with communities to try and combat the spread of hate. She says she's not too worried about how far-right parties will do in the next election.
I don't perceive them doing extraordinarily well in elections, but our biggest fear is that parties will move to the right to chase them.
Ireland is now seen as one of Europe's most socially progressive countries. Abortion and same-sex marriage were both legalised in the last decade. But MacDonald says we shouldn't forget that a significant portion of the electorate voted against those changes.
There's kind of 30% of the Irish voters that didn't vote for marriage equality. And all the mainstream political parties did support the referendum. So they feel they've no political home now.
And she says far-right activists may well try to win over those conservative voters. But some of the loudest far-right voices trying to influence Irish voters right now live very far away from the island.
So the Irish government is trying to replace the population of Ireland with people from the third world, obviously. But why? What's the justification for that? They have a native population and they're being replaced.
That's Tucker Carlson speaking on his show on X a couple of days after the riots. Last week, the Irish Prime Minister announced plans to pass new laws against online hate speech. Elon Musk, the owner of X, tweeted in response that Ireland's Prime Minister hates the Irish people. On the day of the riots, Irish police contacted social media companies TikTok, Instagram, Facebook and X, asking them to remove posts that incited violence. Ireland's Justice Minister said only X, Elon Musk's company, refused to cooperate. Musk has since been tweeting positive replies to posts by Irish far-right activists. Political scientist John O'Brennan says the Irish government could try and tackle the issue of online hate speech, but the real power, he says, lies with the EU and the new Digital Services Act.
The regulation of social media is now just one of the most urgent tasks. And my view is that it can only really be done adequately at scale. And that means at the European Union level.
Far-right parties are now polling higher than 20% in more than half of EU countries, O'Brien says. The Irish government can no longer afford to be complacent, he says. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. The expectations were not high ahead of this year's UN Climate Summit in Dubai. By next week, though, world leaders, for the first time ever, could make a major commitment on addressing the single biggest driver of climate change. Negotiators are working behind closed doors toward a final agreement and grappling with this question, can they commit to phasing out fossil fuels? More than 100 countries are already on board with the idea. Many still oppose it, or they have just stayed silent. That includes Australia, where coal and gas exports make this a politically touchy subject. From Sydney, The World's Sarah Birnbaum has this report.
There's this famous video from the Australian Parliament from 2017.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Scott Morrison, who would soon be Prime Minister, brings a lump of coal into the chamber and proceeds to taunt the opposition with it.
Mr. Speaker, those opposite have an ideological, pathological fear of coal. There's no word for coalophobia officially, Mr. Speaker, but that's the malady that afflicts those opposite.
Over the next few years, as bushfires, droughts and floods ravaged the country, Morrison failed to take the climate crisis seriously. Fast forward to the elections in 2022, and voters had enough of Morrison's deny and delay approach to climate change. Morrison's Liberal Party lost, and he was replaced by Labour's Anthony Albanese, who promised to take Australia out of the naughty corner on climate.
Together, we can end the climate wars. Together, we can take advantage of the opportunity for Australia to be a renewable energy superpower.
Last year, the Labour government passed the first climate change legislation in a decade. The law requires Australia to cut emissions 43% by 2030 and reach net zero emissions by 2050. That's roughly in line with the cuts needed to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. At a power substation deep underground in Sydney, the manager of the regional grid, Marie Jordan, tells me that most of the electricity flowing through the cables surrounding us right now is generated by coal. But that's been changing.
When I arrived here 18 months ago, we were at 80% coal-fired generation. We're already down to 70%.
And it's going to drop even lower.
By 2030, we're going to be in that range of 80% renewable portfolio of energy.
In other words, in only 6 years, the grid here and across Australia will go from mostly coal-powered to mostly fed by solar, wind, and hydro. That's the plan, anyway. In an interview with The Guardian podcast last weekend, Australia's Energy Minister Chris Bowen acknowledged it's a big lift.
It's ambitious but achievable. No point being ambitious and not achievable. No point being achievable but not ambitious.
But even though Australia's domestic policies require a massive move away from coal, oil, and gas, the government doesn't like putting it that way. On the podcast, Bowen was asked repeatedly whether Australia would support explicit language to phase out fossil fuels in the agreement that always comes out on the last day of the COP climate conference.
I will be backing sensible strengthening of the global efforts, and we'll see what coalition emerges internationally in good company, but we'll be in that good company.
Why the evasiveness? Probably because the production of fossil fuels in Australia is going gangbusters. Australia is one of the largest exporters of coal and liquefied natural gas in the world. And it has 116 new coal, oil, and gas projects in the pipeline.
There's two entirely different dimensions to Australia's approach to climate change.
That's Richard Dennis. He's the executive director of the Australia Institute think tank in Canberra.
There's what are we doing domestically? And this government's doing more than the old government. But on the international front, they are in lockstep with the former government.
The Australian Greens have been pushing for a moratorium on new oil and gas projects for export. Prime Minister Albanese has refused time and again, including during this interview last year on Australian public television.
That's not the policy of the Labor Party, and we won't be supporting it because that would have a devastating impact on our economy.
He says if Australia stopped exporting coal tomorrow, countries would just get it from somewhere else.
And that coal wouldn't lead to a reduction in global emissions.
Richard Dennis at the Australia Institute calls this argument the drug dealer's defense.
You know, if I wasn't selling it, someone else should, so what's the harm?
But the science is clear. If the world is to have any chance of holding climate change to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, there can be no new investments in oil, gas, and coal starting now.
It doesn't matter whether the fossil fuels are burned overseas or in Australia. It's going to cook the climate. Our coal exports are going to ruin our reef just as fast as any coal we burn here.
However, the politics aren't so easy, says Felicity Wade. She advises the Australian Labor Party on climate policy.
We're an economy that really relies on our fossil fuels. They have made us very rich. We don't have a particularly sophisticated economy beyond that. And what we've really done very well out of is digging this toxic stuff up and sending it off.
The Business Council of Australia, which is a business lobby, says one in four Australians has a job in a carbon-intensive industry. And of Australia's top five exports, number one, two, and three are iron ore, coal, and gas.
And so you can see why a hard-headed political party goes, well, I'm not about to cut off a couple of our major industries and expect to survive that politically.
Especially when the Labor Party's been burned before. In 2019, it campaigned on ambitious climate reforms and was defeated in a surprise upset. Sky News spoke to voters in Northern Australia's coal country.
Labor's lost the way. They don't look after the workers.
They're no longer representing the working men, as far as I can see.
Do you think their attitude towards coal specifically cost them votes?
Yes, definitely in this town.
Felicity Wade says in 2022, things were different.
We saw this strong support for climate change action in wealthy areas, but also we saw communities which are coal dependent, which in Australia are numerous. They didn't vote against climate action. It wasn't a wedge issue in that way.
But that consensus is fragile, she says.
We've also in Australia in the last 15 years seen what happens when the politics doesn't hold, when you feed the culture war, when people get nervous about their future, progressive governments lose, and then bad governments destroy climate action.
That's why at COP28, Australia's negotiators are treading cautiously, pledging to phase out or down a major driver of the Australian economy, could provoke a political backlash. And the last thing the government wants to do is reignite the climate wars. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
Tomorrow on the show, we look at how a possible fossil fuel phase-out is being seen from Ghana, where the president wants to use the country's natural resources to build Ghana's expanding economy. The Ukraine counteroffensive. There were high hopes for the military campaign that began earlier this year, but it did not produce the results that many wanted to see.
Ukrainians paying incredible price tried to push through Russian positions, but effectiveness of those actions was very, very limited.
What happened to the Ukrainian counteroffensive? Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston, NPRX. The Israeli military says its troops are operating in the center of Khan Yunis. That's the largest city in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, where the majority of the Palestinian civilian population has now fled. Israeli authorities have been sending people in Gaza evacuation instructions to find safety. But inside the territory, locals and aid groups say nowhere is really safe. The U.S. is calling on Israel to do more to protect civilians and vital infrastructure in Gaza. To discuss Israel's strategy and the international pressure it's facing, we're joined by Aaron Bregman. He's a professor in the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Aaron, what is the Israeli military trying to accomplish in southern Gaza right now?
What the Israelis are trying to do is basically two things. Number one, to try and topple Hamas and a Khan Yunis is the stronghold, if you want, of Hamas with a very strong support there. And aim number two is to put enough pressure on Hamas so that they will agree to release the Israeli hostages. There are more than 100 hostages held by Hamas.
I mean, don't those two goals seem to be kind of contradictory? You want to release the hostages, but you also want to topple Hamas at the same time, which has the ability to release the hostages.
It's very tricky for the military to operate now, especially as it is likely that the hostages, the more than 100 hostages, are in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. So it is a more limited area where they have to operate. It's very difficult because the two aims are, you know, just opposed.
Israeli officials say the military has killed about 5,000 militants. That's out of about 15,000 reported deaths in Gaza. What do you make of that estimate?
Well, I don't know if we really know how many people are combatants or terrorists, as the Israelis call them. What we do know is the number of casualties very high, and the Israelis just started to do the second phase of the operation.
So the Biden administration has been making more public demands from Israel to prevent civilian deaths and infrastructure damage in Gaza. How much of an impact, though, do you think that's having?
It is the first time in the history of the State of Israel that American officials are sitting in cabinet meetings, never heard before. So they are really committed, and they know the plans, and they come with ideas, and I believe that they have some influence on the Israeli behavior. They could say to the Israelis, if at some stage, enough is enough, if you don't stop, we will reduce the amount of weapons we are sending you.
Do you really think that the U.S. will come to a point where they say enough is enough with the military aid to Israel?
If they don't have to announce it publicly, they can say to the Israelis, you have to bring an end to it. I think that an end to it will come naturally anyway, because winter is around the corner. It will be very difficult for the Israelis to fight in the very muddy Gaza Strip. And I remember the place in the winter because I served there as a young soldier. It's a very unpleasant experience. So I think that it will come to an end anyway.
Even if the hostage situation is not settled?
You know, so far, there is understanding in the American, in the Biden administration, that the Israelis should achieve something. Achieving something is to, for example, to release the hostages. There are more than 100 hostages still held in Hamas. The Biden administration is as keen as the Israelis that Hamas will not be there. But I think that the Americans understand that it is just impossible to achieve. And therefore, they will want an exit strategy from the Israelis. And they also want to see a plan for the day after.
Professor, has Israel ever carried out anything like this sort of campaign before?
No, never. This is something totally new, especially vis-a-vis Gaza. Past wars, you know, 1967, 1973, 1982, even the 2006 war were relatively short. This one is very long, already 2 months, and they are operating in areas where there are many civilians, and it is very complicated with a big, big restriction that the Israelis have their hostages held somewhere in a tunnel in the Gaza Strip, and they have to try and topple Hamas and at the same time trying not to kill their own people. Never heard before.
And what does that lack of historic precedents tell us possibly about the future of this campaign, about this war?
Well, I believe that in the end, it will be another round of war between Israel and Hamas. Hamas, they don't need any big victory. All they need is to survive and to be able to stand on the feet and say, we are still here. So they are going to be there when the war is ended, and it will be just another round between Israel and Gaza, a brutal one, much tougher than the previous one, but it's going to be just another round.
Aaron Bregman is a professor at King's College London. He's also the author of Cursed Victory, Israel and the Occupied Territories. Professor Bregman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. All the best.
The ruling Communist Party in Vietnam calls it the Blazing Furnace. That is the nickname for the government's crusade against corruption, where anyone who gets caught up in it can get burned. State prosecutors are now talking about the country's biggest known fraud case. It's a plot involving dozens of officials, boxes stuffed with ill-gotten cash. Typically, Vietnam's government tightly controls bad news, but as the world's Patrick Wynn reports, in this particular case, it's divulging gritty details.
The numbers are truly jaw-dropping. If Vietnam's government is correct, a wealthy real estate tycoon in Ho Chi Minh City oversaw bank fraud worth $12.5 billion. That's equivalent to 3% of Vietnam's entire GDP.
These are huge amounts of money. I mean, if it's 12.5, that's one of the largest financial crimes in world history.
Michael Tatarsky is an independent journalist in Ho Chi Minh City, running an online newsletter called Vietnam Weekly. The biggest known embezzlement case in Asia was a conspiracy in Malaysia exposed 7 years back, worth $4.5 billion. But the case unfolding in Vietnam could smash that record. Its alleged mastermind is a woman named Trung My Lan, a real estate mogul in her late 60s. There aren't many public photos of her or her family. There are just a few with Lan smiling, wearing jeweled necklaces.
They have essentially no public profile, not really any social media presence, so extremely secretive despite owning much of the most high-profile real estate in Ho Chi Minh City.
The latest photo of Madame Lan, as Vietnam's media call her, is a mugshot. She looks very stressed. She's accused of an elaborate scam, using proxies to covertly control a large bank, Saigon Commercial Bank. Investigators say over the last 10 years, she would pull out money at will through shell companies and phony loans. Some of that money reportedly went to officials to keep them quiet. One banking regulator got $5.2 million, according to investigators speaking to state-run media. That would be the largest bribe ever recorded in Vietnam. And none of this makes Vietnam look good. And yet, Tatarsky says, state-run media seem to have free rein to reveal dirt on Madame Lan, even how she paid off officials.
It has been quite striking. Like, this official received a bag of cash at 11 a.m. on this street, and here is security camera footage of it happening.
Vietnam's anti-corruption campaign isn't new, though recently it's grown more aggressive. Officials tout it as a way to show foreign investors Vietnam is a good place to do business. And on the surface, this crusade does look unflinching. But Ling Nguyen, an analyst for Control Risks, a London-based consultancy, says the truth is more complex.
Obviously, they are targeting corruption, but it's not the full story.
Vietnam's Communist Party will take down big players. In January, amid graft allegations, the president resigned, and two deputy prime ministers got fired. Dozens of other officials and business people are in prison over corruption. But Nguyen says the party is selective. Corporations and bureaucrats tightly linked to the party's reigning faction seem to get a pass.
It's political infighting, cracking down on your political rivals.
This political infighting isn't always obvious to everyday citizens, she says. But they do love seeing takedowns of elites.
Oh, it is definitely very popular among people.
The architect of this blazing furnace crusade is the General Secretary of Vietnam's Communist Party, Nguyen Phu Trong. He calls lightly corrupt figures new wood and super corrupt people dry wood. Dry wood, he says, is what makes the furnace really blaze. Because anti-corruption is the General Secretary's signature policy, Ling Wen says it is here to stay.
I have no doubt that this will last a lot longer. There are at least 4 or 5 major cases lining up in the next 6 months waiting for prosecution.
For now, the campaign is still focused on Vietnam's finance sector. And Vietnam, in recent years, has sentenced people to death over banking crimes. Madam Lan is expected to face trial early next year. For The World, this is Patrick Nguyen.
You might have noticed a critter called the axolotl on social media in recent days. It is a really cute salamander with feathery gills and what looks like a big, permanent smile. It's one of those species that when you look at it, all you want to do is go, aww. But the axolotl is in deep trouble. Scientists in Mexico are desperately trying to save this iconic species from extinction. One thing that's possibly in the axolotl's favor, precisely its cuteness. Diogo Verissimo is a conservation scientist at the University of Oxford. He joins us from the UK. Just how dire is the situation for the axolotl, Diogo?
It's no doubt a creature that is somewhat in trouble. So its habitat, so the lake that it lives in and the freshwater habitats are heavily polluted. This is because of human activity. Lots of people live around, for example, Mexico City. And so these human activities mean the axolotl has fewer and fewer places to live in, right? And so, of course, that means fewer and fewer axolotls overall.
I mean, all species have their function in an ecosystem, but in the case of the axolotl, how important is it as a species? Like, what would change if the axolotl sadly disappeared?
It's always a little bit hard to answer that question exactly. Also, because sometimes, you know, nature can change in ways that are not immediately perceptible, right? We might only find out several years down the road, oh, actually, you know, things have changed this way. So now the landscape looks different or it no longer performs all the functions that help us live our everyday lives. But I think in the case of the axolotl, one of the things worth noting is that it's not just about the ecological function of the animal, right? So the animal has a deep history linked with the cultures that have been in that area around Mexico City for a very long time. And so it's not just about its function in the ecosystem, but it's also its role within our own human cultures, right? That it's also important. It's also a piece of that that goes away if the axolotl goes extinct.
I mean, the axolotl is revered in Mexico. Is that affecting the interest in saving it, that it's a kind of national symbol and really isolated to this one part of Mexico City, as you said?
Yeah, sure. So if you're an amphibian, right, if you're a salamander, all those things are really critical because, of course, salamanders and amphibians more broadly are not necessarily on the top of everyone's favorite animals, right? And so if you're an axolotl, you need your permanent smile, you need your cultural linkages, you need your gills, your feathery gills, right? Like you said, so that you can heighten your profile and get people to be a bit more excited than naturally would be about, you know, a regular salamander they find in their backyard.
Yeah, that permanent smile, the axolotl. I mean, it's a weird thing to point out, perhaps, when we're talking survival versus extinction. But how does the cuteness or charisma of a species affect our interest in saving it?
I think for the better, for the worse, often it's perhaps something we regard as a little bit distasteful, that we have this beauty bias. But it is true. So, you know, all across the world, whether being in the United States with Endangered Species Act, or in the European Union with, you know, different policies that we have that are similar and that where we have to choose which species we want to put the resources to conserve. Again and again and again, we see that the species that have the highest profile, the species that we care the most about, largely because they're in some way impressive, right? Maybe because they're big, maybe because they're big predators, for example, right? Or because they look like us, right? So there's different ways that species can become sort of notorious, but certainly that is always a major factor when it comes to decisions of what gets protected, what gets funded. And of course, you know, with the axolotl, what we're seeing now is public display of support, right? All these people coming together to donate to save the axolotl, and not just once, right? So the campaign that we're seeing now is a relaunch of another campaign also to conserve the axolotl so that, you know, frequently, repeatedly, people are showing this support for this species, I would guess, largely because of these traits.
How important are axolotls biologically? Like, they've got this ability to regenerate their limbs, so they always stay young. Is that unique?
My understanding is that this cuts across several species of salamanders, right? It receives a lot of interest from us lowly humans who cannot do anything, you know, like that. You know, you asked me in the beginning about what happens if an axolotl disappears. Does the landscape, does the ecosystem really change that much? What do we lose? Well, you know, I think sometimes we also lose this ability to learn more from nature and understand more, you know, how does the axolotl do it? And could that be a pathway to sometime in the future, humans themselves also being able to do something maybe similar? So I think that's also that future option. We'd be a poorer world if we lost the axolotl.
Diogo Verissimo is a research fellow at the University of Oxford. He's been speaking to us from Oxford, England. Diogo, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, and have a good day.
William Wallace, Britney Spears, Greta Thunberg. These are names presumably suggested as affectionate homage that may soon be given to Scottish snowplows. Each year, the company that runs Scotland's snowplow service opens a public contest to name the few hundred plow trucks it operates, or gritters, as the Scots call them. Keanu Freeze has already made the cut. The annual tradition is a crowd pleaser. It goes viral on social media, yielding punny results from past years like Skid Vicious and Sweet Child O'Brien. The UK, of course, no stranger to giving the public free rein in naming big pieces of equipment with entertaining results. In 2016, the British public memorably voted on the name of a multi-million dollar polar research ship, christening it the RSS Bodie McBoatface. Maybe it's just a cold weather thing. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Russian artillery hit the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson today, according to local officials, killing two people there. Meanwhile, Ukraine says it downed more Russian drones and missiles. It's all an illustration of the grind that Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has turned into, neither side with a clear upper hand. Ukraine's much-anticipated counteroffensive that many hoped would change the course of the war has probably run its course. Earlier this year, the U.S. rushed to outfit and train Ukraine's military ahead of that campaign. The plan was to retake cities and towns occupied by Russian forces. As winter has set in, though, the counteroffensive has stalled. The World's Daniel Hoffman looks at what happened.
When they launched the operation in early June, many Ukrainians were eager to see results on the battlefield. After all, Ukraine had received tanks, armored vehicles, and military training from Western partners. But if we fast forward to today, Ukraine's offensive has mostly come to a halt. Last week, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke about the need to enhance fortification and build up defenses. So what happened to Ukraine's counteroffensive? Here's Sergei Grabsky, a retired colonel from Ukraine's armed forces.
Ukrainians, paying incredible price, try to push through Russian positions, but effectiveness of those actions was very, very limited.
Ukraine was attempting to liberate territory in the southern part of the country, but that goal was thwarted by Russian defenses.
The Russians, I may say incredibly, develop their defense lines, and Russians use abnormal density of minefields. Russians actually put minefields everywhere.
Those minefields made it much harder for troops to quickly maneuver using Western tanks and armored vehicles.
After 1 week of desperate attacks, after losing quite significant amount of troops and armament, Ukrainians changed their tactics and turned to attacks using small groups of troops.
Grabsky says there's another key factor here. Ukraine hasn't enjoyed air superiority. According to Grabsky, Western countries haven't provided everything that Ukraine needs to conduct a large-scale offensive operation. However, looking at territorial gains and losses isn't the only way to evaluate military performance.
The deterioration of the Russian military power has become faster since starting of the Ukrainian counteroffensive.
This is Pavel Luzin, a visiting scholar at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
This deterioration is not only on the battlefield, but it is visible also in Russian domestic politics. Remember Prigozhin's mutiny.
Russian mercenary leader Yevgeny Prigozhin launched a mutiny in late June.
Совет командиров ЧВК Вагнер принял решение.
His fighters captured a major city in southern Russia and began their march on Moscow. And although they stopped short, Luzin believes that the mutiny says a lot about the state of Russia's military.
The Russian military demonstrated that they are not going to fight against guys like Prigozhin. That means that the Russian armed forces as an institution of the Russian state are deteriorating.
Luzin says moments like the Prigozhin mutiny show the limits of the Kremlin's control. He also says that Russia has major shortcomings when it comes to military production.
Russia's arms manufacturing is suffering from the skyrocketing cost plus inflation, lack of human capital, And also the Russian military industry spreads limited resources among too many programs and projects.
Luzin says that Russia's military industry production is stretched too thin. It can't replenish munitions at the same rate that Russia is using them. But Ukraine and some of its Western partners have experienced similar problems. Here's Alina Polyakova, president and CEO of the Center for European Policy Analysis.
We have seen how really mismanaged and weak European investments in defense have been for decades. And that's not something that can be rebuilt within 3 to 5 years. That is a generational investment.
However, Polyakova says this is something that European countries and the U.S. can correct if there's enough political will.
All of America's adversaries are, of course, watching very, very closely if the U.S. will have the resolve together with Europe to see the war in Ukraine through, or whether Mr. Putin will persevere.
Support for enhanced military aid has somewhat wavered recently in the U.S. and in some European countries. But Polyakova believes that continued support for Ukraine is crucial for maintaining European security.
If Ukraine falls, if Ukraine remains a so-called gray zone where the Russians can basically turn up the heat and turn it down whenever they want, this means that Russia will have control over European security for the long term.
Polyakova says that in the future, to really bolster European security, Ukraine needs to be accepted as a full-fledged member of NATO. For now, she says, providing it with the weapons it needs to defend itself is the bare minimum. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
We leave you today in a dystopian world imagined by Danish punk rockers. The Copenhagen-based Fabled Mind have released a concept album called Project Paradise. Things start optimistically enough, just like the thing that the title refers to. Project Paradise is a form of artificial intelligence.
Welcome to Project Paradise. Choose between thousands of worlds where you can be a star, a hero, or even a god. We are here to make you happy.
If making you happy is the goal of the fictitious Project Paradise, it is not working for Fabled Mind. The remainder of the band's album is a singer struggling with the idea that his thoughts are being controlled by some faceless technology and wondering whether anything he thinks is really real. That's when the angry punk aesthetic takes over the music, like here in the first single from the album, Algorithm. Suffice it to say that in the continuing debates over artificial intelligence, there is a side, one that includes many musicians and artists, that is deeply concerned over the ownership of their work. One might even say angry over what the future could look like. Denmark's Fabled Mind there putting that anger to music. That is our show on this Tuesday. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online all the time at theworld.org. Be safe. Stay strong. We're back with you again tomorrow.
Hi there. Just a moment before you go. We know that there are so many competing requests for your time and resources right now, especially as we head toward the end of the year. So thank you for being with us day in and day out as we deliver the best in international journalism with nuance and care. We are grateful to count you among our listeners. Your notes of support are a bright spot in our day. Thank you. If you haven't yet, there is still time to give. And as we head into 2024, your support is more important than ever. So if you can, I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.